Welcome to a study of the Book of Ephesians. Our speaker, Dr. Ken Boa, is president of Reflections Ministries and Trinity House Publishers. Today, he looks at service, social media, and speech. Here's Dr. Ken Boa.
We've been looking at the end of chapter 4 of Ephesians, and it deals with incredibly important issues. I know it's been a long journey through this book, but at the same time, there's reasons for this, because it's so rich in material that it once makes me want to stop and pause and reflect on some of the incredible insights that are found here and how timeless and applicable they all are. And that's what I'm impressed with, again, with the fact that human nature doesn't change. And though cultures do, the words of counsel, of exhortation, of comfort, of rebuke in these epistles of Paul, as well as the rest of the scriptures, are incredibly timeless and relevant to our own condition. And we've been talking about the issue of truth versus falsehood. He talked then about the whole issue of anger and not letting the sun go down on your anger and not to give the devil an opportunity, and we discussed that in some depth. Then he talks here about let him who steals steal no longer. And in our last session, we talked a little bit about a biblical view of work, which is just a kind of a preview of a series I'd like to do with you on looking at work as a mode of worship. And this is a radical departure from the typical approach that I have normally been raised with, that supposed somehow that there was a sacred secular divide and that tried to compartmentalize our lives so that these things over here are spiritual, but then the other things you do, those are not spiritual, they're secular. And the notion, which is such that here we're doing something spiritual, but in a couple of hours it'll be secular, is just completely misguided. And my view is actually we are in an arena where we're trying to encourage one another so that we can manifest eternal values in this temporal arena and do it by way of service to the King with excellence and integrity, knowing that we're playing to an audience of one, not seeking to impress people. But at the same time, the more we seek to please the one, the more we are capable of serving others. And at the same time, the less we're dependent upon their opinions and expectations. So we're delivered from that bondage, but at the same time, we become actually better stewards and servants, not less. And so the concept here in work, then, is that we are actually seeing ourselves as men who are given a calling, a vocare. And remember, we use that word vocare, Latin word, sounds familiar, doesn't it? We get the word vocation from that. And vocation has come to mean a job in our time, but that's more of a specific image. It's actually broader than that. Vocare, calling, is what we're talking about. We're talking about a calling that transcends merely a career or a job within that career. We're talking about a calling that God has planted on our lives, put us here for a reason, that you're not a cosmic accident, but you're here for a purpose, and that God's intention is for us to be men who are agents of change that last forever, that there's eternal change. Remember, we're taking eternal truth. God's word endures forever, and we're speaking it to eternal beings. You've never met a mere mortal, as C.S. Lewis put it. But you're dealing with immortal beings. Consequently, you are set in this temporal arena in order to manifest eternal truth and incarnate that truth in such a way that it has an impact on eternal beings. And a life well led, then, is a life that transmutes the temporal into the eternal, by taking the temporal resources of this world, which are passing away, and transmuting it into the currency of heaven, which goes on forever, and that's relationships. So at the end of the day, we can see our work as a component of this. The way we serve our customers and clients is a way we serve God. If we come to see the way we serve our employees and the way we work with our employees is the way we also minister to Him, if we come to see ourselves as accountable to Him, and we see ourselves as people who are called to the dignity of an external expression of an internal identity, such that the work is a manifestation of an identity rather than something that causes us to be identified. You're more than what you do. But you bring an identification, you bring yourself to that doing sphere, and you redefine it, you transmute it. And the consequence is that you become a kind of sub-creator, where you take the raw materials of this world and you create value, and you create capital, and you create resources, and you create work and jobs, and you create wealth that can be used in specific ways for the betterment of other people. And I believe that this is really a more biblical way of looking at work than what at least I've normally been exposed to. And so I want you to see then that you do your business to the glory of God, that what you do at 9 o'clock on Monday morning is as spiritual as what you do at 11 o'clock on Sunday morning. If we can see it that way, and we can begin to see that it is the power of the laity who go into this world and have spheres of influence that God has actually ordained for us, that God has put you in a sphere, a matrix of relationships, and you are accountable to that matrix, to those people. You've been given a calling, and you're accountable for the way you love and serve and work with those people. So you're called to be a man of integrity, whose yes is yes and whose no is no, whose word is his bond. A man then who transcends the typical values around us. And I believe that that's a high and holy calling, and it gives us incredible dignity. That's really what I'm exploring here. And at the same time, in a fallen world, there are going to be times where we have to do the right thing according to God's standards and not the world's. There are going to be times when we go against the work of the world, and there's going to be gray areas that we need to really evaluate and ask ourselves, what are our convictions at work? And thus, there are going to be times where I believe a follower of Jesus may well lose what appears to be a competitive edge precisely because they're not willing to cut corners, because they're willing to do the right thing. And when they do that, then they have to trust God for the outcome. They have to be faithful to the process in such a way that they honor God, and then they have to trust God for the results. Otherwise, they will not do the right thing. They'll allow the agenda of betterment, as the world defines it, to somehow define them, and then they will begin to lose the courage of conviction. And when they do that, they begin to become people who lose that vocari. They no longer live out the calling that they were given. And so that's a vision of work that I think is important. That's why he says, must labor, performing with his own hands what is good. But he goes on to say, so that he will have something to share with the one who has need. And this is important. As we see it, at work, we're able to help others. It's a sphere in which we are given the power now to help other people. And we are called then, as we grow in maturity, to generosity. And the way in which we can kind of determine our value system is by looking at two books, our checkbook and our pocketbook, to use that phrase, an old phrase for your wallet. But the idea here is that your checkbook, calendar is what I mean, your pocketbook and your calendar, your day timer now it would be, or a PDF. Or PDA, rather. You know, it's all the rules are changing all around us here. I'm an odd duck. I have an iPad. I have an iPhone 4. I use all that stuff, but I still have a day timer. And the reason for this, I want to have a link into the world of that which is tactile and tangible. There are reasons for this. I'm an odd duck. I have to hold one. I'm still tethered to the old. But the interesting thing is, however you use your calendar, it's going to be the way you spend your money and the way you allocate your time that will determine, or perhaps I should better say, reveal priorities. One can talk a good game, but it's the way they use their resources of time and wealth that will really shape a vision of how their priorities look. And if that does not include generosity, and such that we actually acquire wealth so that we can share it with others, which is what this vision is, then we're really missing out on part of our calling. So we do this, and I believe by our financial generosity to the kingdom, we acknowledge that true reality lies in the next world and not in this one. This is the real purpose of giving. It's the allocation of our financial resources to eternal things. So as we see it then, God doesn't want our gold, He wants our hearts. Clearly that's the case. But sometimes the test of whether or not He has our hearts is our willingness to give Him our gold. So it comes down to that. That often becomes a real test in our own lives and in our journeys. I've been going through a little devotional book called A Minute of Margin. How many of you have read Richard Swenson's book, Margin? It came out a number of years ago, maybe 15 years ago. And this is a book that came out several years ago, I think maybe 2003. And it's called A Minute of Margin. And it has 180 little two-page devotionals, so you can do it very quickly. And I try to do this, one of the things I do before going to sleep, just a kind of perspective. And it's kind of like a breath of fresh air from time to time because it shakes you out of the illusion of being in this world where you have a lack of margin and where we have constant pressure on our times, where we get burned out and always living at the edge without having any kind of movement. Margin, which is physical margin, spiritual margin, emotional margin, relational margin, financial margin, having enough so that we're not always at the end pushing it and pushing it, which is what our culture would tell us to do, that progress seems to be defined as speeding things up. But I noticed that our time-saving devices don't save time. They actually require us now to serve them even more. Yes, it's true, and I'm conflicted about this. I can accomplish a great deal more through email and technology, through sending attachments, through scanning documents, and a whole variety of things. I can do a great deal more than I used to be able to do, especially as an author. Having a word processor. Remember before the actual laptop came out, there were these Lanier word processors, and I still was fascinated when I first came to Atlanta to work for Walk Through the Bible in 1979. Ooh, look at this thing! You don't have to type. You can correct your errors and all that stuff. You don't need whiteout. I was stunned by this thing. You know, it's just interesting how you take things for granted now. It changed, but the idea of being able to type something in there, try this phrase, go back and forth, this is the better way to go. That just changed my life as a writer. And it changed my ability to accomplish things. And thus, in the course of a day, my productivity, quote, can go up substantially. On the other hand, it takes time away from solitude and silence in many cases. It takes time away from reading. I remember what I used to do in the hours that I have to spend on emails now. Yeah, I'm accomplishing more. I'm in touch with more people. That's a dangerous thing because they're in touch with me. And they have all kinds of access to me, and it's kind of scary to me as a result. Just yesterday, I had to answer 5 inquiries that people had that they didn't want to look up themselves, I suppose. So people asked, would you please work for me? Here's what I want you to do, Ken. Even though I'm only an acquaintance of yours, in fact, you may hardly know me at all, what I want you to do for me is to read this document and then give me your opinion. Oh, thank you. That'll take about 15, 20 minutes, half an hour to read that document, and then I'll have to craft an opinion for you. I don't even know you from Adam's house cat. Now stop and think about that, what people are supposing, and they impose their agenda upon you, and it's incredible. So I have to continue to use a lot of boundaries. I have to have boundaries in these situations all the time. And insofar as I am now using social media, that's another danger. And I don't use it, as you know, as I've said before. I'm on Kenneth Boa at Facebook and Twitter. And I do this, as I told you a couple of times before, not because I'm interested in telling you what I'm doing at a particular hour. Hey, I'm at McDonald's with my friend Henry now. Why do I care? Why would somebody care where you are? I had several people that were doing this, and I had to just stop following them. In fact, I don't follow anybody now. How can someone follow 500 people on Twitter? That's absurd. But people claim they can do that. At any rate, I don't. I'm down to where I don't follow anybody. All I'm doing is sending out two little things a day, two shots of things that I have found to be beneficial to me, bits of wisdom. And I just throw that on Facebook and Twitter and can link it to my blog, and that's what I do. But as far as, I don't need friends. Someone is you're now friends with so-and-so. They're not my friends. You know, I don't know. Again, I don't know these people. I had a weird experience where a guy from Norway found me, and his name is Kenneth Boa. And he wanted to be connected. So then it says, Kenneth Boa is now connected to Kenneth Boa. That was a really weird experience. little identity problem there. Reminds me of Charlie Chaplin. Charlie Chaplin once entered a Charlie Chaplin look-alike contest in Monte Carlo. He came in third place. you can actually forget your identity here. You know, it's kind of bizarre. So, again, these things, I've got to control them and have boundaries or they'll rule my life. And that's where I go with that. So I have to be very careful. Yes, I can minister and serve people in various ways, but I have to be very careful that it doesn't consume me. There are draining people in everyone's life. Have you noticed this? A lot of people have draining people. And there is something to be said for them because they teach us patience and servanthood and so forth. But you have to manage your time carefully so that otherwise they'll take all your time. That's just the way that works. Nevertheless, margin in finances, his eighth reflection, was to me an interesting one. He says first by lowering, any discussion of financial margin would be incomplete without mentioning the pure joy of it. There are three reasons this is so. First, by lowering expenses below income, you live with far less stress and pressure. If the refrigerator breaks down, you don't. If your car needs new tires, you simply go out and get them. Without margin, life struggles and staggers and stumbles. But when margin's present, life flows. And flowing is more enjoyable than staggering. And he's absolutely right. Having a little bit of movement, a little wiggle room, is a good thing in this world. That's why we have to make time for margin. You have to create that. You have to craft that. You have to determine what are my convictions. How do I spend my time? Where are the boundaries? Those kinds of questions. And I have formulated for myself very specific boundaries concerning email, social media, and things like that, so it doesn't consume me. So it's a good servant, but a very poor master. And that's why I have to constantly revisit this, because technology is a mixed blessing. Second, he says, having financial margin allows beneficence toward others. This is one of the most rewarding of all human activities, and I'm convinced it is a subset of love. Meeting the needs of others delivers us from the world of selfishness and into a world of grace and gratitude. And that's a good word, isn't it? A world of grace and gratitude. We've said many times before that the key to humility is realizing that everything you have is a gift. Everything you have, all your abilities, your time, everything you are and have has been given to you. It's grace. And when you realize that, then you realize, I don't have anything that wasn't given to me. Then why do I boast as if it wasn't? He goes on to say, these two sources of joy are sufficient grounds to recommend margin, but there is yet a third, even greater source of joy. And this is the part I really wanted you to hear. It is a transcendent kind of pleasure that comes neither from within nor without, but from above. It comes from the source of all that is right. And when you approach it, you feel its warmth even from a distance. In giving, you are ushered into a world where cynicism and hatred have been banished. It's an interesting notion, isn't it? Because there is a sin. What's in it for you? What's in it for me? This notion. And sometimes you try to do something beneficial, and there can be a cynical response. They're trying to set me up, or they're trying to manipulate me. And by the way, after a while, when people realize that this is what you're doing, you're loving and serving them, and you're not looking for anything in return, that can really affect people's attitude profoundly. But sometimes they're so cynical, it takes a while to win them over, to realize I don't have a hidden agenda. I'm not trying to be in this relationship to get something, though so often we are, and that's a danger. He says, you're considering others before yourself. You're choosing heaven as the place you will put your treasure. You're doing what God asked you to do and what he did himself. And that's an important principle. Again, we've said many times that Jesus never asked us to do something for others that he has not already done for us. It's an important principle. If he asks us to love others, it's because he loved us first. To forgive others, it's because he forgave us first. To serve others, it's because he served us first. And you could go down a whole line. It is more blessed to give than to receive, Jesus taught. And these words are not talking about a future tense theoretical blessing waiting for us beyond the eternal horizon reserved there as a compensation for the excruciating pain of giving today. I just like that way of putting it. And this is the part. Listen carefully. Instead, this is a kind of joy that begins with the thought of giving, with the declaration of freedom in your soul that indeed you belong to God. And the joy culminates in the act of giving, often a secret except for the spotlight of heaven. Again, you're playing to an invisible audience. One of the spiritual disciplines is secrecy. The discipline of secrecy is the willingness to do good to others without having to be noticed, without needing to get the credit, that sort of thing. And that is a very interesting thing to try out sometime. This is why some people may give anonymously. The danger there is that you give anonymously and you're proud of it. And you tell people, hey, I gave this a lot of money anonymously. Well, you know, you have to be, it's a tricky business. It's like I'm humble and proud of it. So you have to, we're very tricky creatures. There are certain virtues that are systematically self-destructive as soon as you're aware of them. One of them is righteousness, another one's wisdom, and the other is humility. As soon as you think you have those, there's maybe a problem. German existentialist Friedrich Nietzsche once claimed that Christians have no joy. But joy is mentioned over 500 times in the scriptures. That's an important topic to discuss sometime. And clearly ought to be a part of the normal Christian life. If you wince because Nietzsche's dagger finds a joyless heart, restore your financial margin and then give it away. So the joy of using money for transcendent purposes, that's what we're talking about here. Leveraging currency of the temporal for eternal gain. This Sunday I'm going to be preaching a sermon on Luke 16. And it's the parable of the unjust steward. Maybe you remember how that one went. But there's a point at which he says, I tell you, make friends for yourself by means of the mammon of unrighteousness, the wealth of unrighteousness, so that when it fails, there may be friends who will welcome you into the eternal dwellings. What Jesus is saying is when the wealth of unrighteousness, because money is not neutral, when it fails, which means when you die, you can't send it ahead, yet you can send something ahead, and that's relationships. So that when it fails, when you die, there'll be people to welcome you into the eternal dwellings. That means if you can take the time that God's given you, which is brief and ephemeral, if you can take the abilities that God has given you, which are not your own, and if you can take the possessions and resources that God has given you, that mammon that Jesus uses, speaking an Aramaic term for any form of wealth, whether money or other forms, that's passing away. Wouldn't it be a wise thing to take that which is passing away and somehow through the alchemy of the Spirit turn it, that lead, into the gold of relationships? so that now it will actually last and there'll be people to welcome you into the eternal dwellings. You see that? That's the currency of heaven. And that's what we're talking about here. So in my view, this is a joy, and giving to kingdom purposes is in fact a great blessing and a great privilege for us to do. And by the way, I would encourage you, and this is just parenthetical before I go and I want to finish the rest of this chapter, but I would encourage you to consider this matter of giving. And I'm not speaking specifically of my ministry. There are many ministries that you can give to. And I seek to invest in the lives of people that I believe in and ministries that I believe in. And my desire is to increase that percentage every year. And I've sought to do that for a number of years. And don't play games, by the way. Do it off the total, not the net. Okay, so no games there. Do it off the gross. And figure out a percentage. And by the way, the New Testament transcends the tithe. The tithe was an Old Testament principle. The New Testament tells us giving is to be sacrificial, proportionate, and cheerful. And that is a very dramatically different vision. So that if that's true, if it's proportionate, that means the wealthier we are, the higher percentage we can give away. Ironically, the wealthier we are, the lower the percentage they give away. That's a bizarre thought, isn't it? Something's wrong there. Nor is it ever sacrificial in many cases. The point is, can you be willing to take the risk of upping the ante of the money that you put into the kingdom of God and believe that God will take care of the difference? It's my conviction that he will more than make up for that difference. Try him, test him, and see if he will not do that. And you're not giving away to get. But nevertheless, it's my belief that you can't outgive God. That's my belief. And try it out and see. Do this experiment. Bump it up a little bit and see if he will not cover you. I'm suggesting that as a vehicle. We're giving, God loves a what? Cheerful giver. And it means that a person gives it with joy, that they are pleased to do it. They're given this privilege of doing this. And we have to see that as an incredible way of investing in lives and in eternity. And that's why, again, we want to use our money well and wisely. And let me see if there are any closing, any questions before I move on to the next verse. Yeah, Joe?
There are a couple of thoughts justifying a behavior and saying, well, this is about stewardship. I have to be a good steward. And it's really, what are my motives? Why did I do it?
That's correct. A lot of people will give money away to placate a guilty conscience. And that's not going to be... And what do they think, God's stupid? Oh, gee, I know you did that in an unethical way, but gosh, you gave it away. Oh, I think I'll let it go. God is not stupid. Remember, I've told you before, I've often thought of writing a book called People Must Think God is Stupid. It would be a very interesting book. I have many chapters in this book. Many chapters. Because people think that God's somehow not looking, you know. That's why they do stupid things when that they wouldn't do when people are around. What do they think, God's invisible, he's not there? You know, this sort of thing stuns me. At any rate, no, he's not going to be deceived by that, nor is he impressed with doing what appears to be a right thing for the wrong reason. It's your intentionality that makes all the difference. Holy intention is what God looks. He looks at the heart. He doesn't look at the surface. And that is why it's very important. If you ever, it just popped into my mind, a movie that I like to watch around Christmas time each year. It came out in 1947. It's called The Bishop's Wife. David Niven, Loretta Young, and let's see who else was in it. Cary Grant's in it. But Cary Grant plays this kind of a visitor from heaven. He's visiting this bishop, and all this bishop is thinking about is building this great cathedral in New York City. That's his big ambition. And he's willing to kind of run roughshod over his relationships with his wife, with his daughter, with his secretary, with people around him. And he kind of is always seeking to curry favor with the largest benefactor that will help them build this cathedral. And it's a very interesting move that he has a desire, a good desire, but he has to be willing to let the thing die and to begin to see that God's not interested in some kind of edifice. That's where we come up with this thing called the edifice complex. It's true. What do you think God's impressed? Once again, do you think God's impressed with buildings, with budgets? He's not even impressed by body count. He's not impressed by numbers. It is not the question of a big splash or a small little impact, but rather fidelity. What have you done with what you've been given? That's why Mother Teresa said, God did not call me to success. He called me to faithfulness. When she was asked, what impact are you having in the gutters of Calcutta when there are so many tens, indeed hundreds of thousands of people whose needs you will not touch? She said, I'm called to recognize Jesus in each person one by one. And I'm called to serve them. God will take care of the other matter. So it's not a question of largeness. It's a question of intentionality. It's a question of the purity of heart that wills one thing, which is to be pleasing to Him, whether it's in large spheres that will be noticed or whether it will be done anonymously. And there is this constant pull that we have, always this desire for the accolades of men, for the approval, because we have, I fear, a greater fear of people's opinions than we do of God's. There's a greater fear of man than there is of God. I'll let you process that a little bit. And that's why God knows this and calls us to accountability with visible people. Any other questions? Yes.
Just a comment. Nietzsche, talking about Christians being joyless, talk about the pot.
Well, you're absolutely right. Nietzsche was one of the most joyless persons I ever knew about or read about. And, of course, he ended his life in an insane asylum and basically became a madman. But he was a man who was increasingly livid with hate because he was basically fighting against any source of rationality, of any meaning, of any hope and purpose. And he knew in his heart of hearts that he could not live in a way that was consistent with the logical implications of his non-theistic presuppositions. He just couldn't do it. And so a man is fighting within himself and is trying to live an unlivable philosophy can be a rather frustrating experience.
He did call men's motives into view. He said, for instance, the bishop, he would say, "Ah, I see you're calling men to God, are you?" And he would say, "Are you calling men to God so you can build a cathedral? Are you calling men to God so that it might be saved?" So Nietzsche and Jesus agree. You got to really pay attention.
That you have to. Yeah, when those two agree, that's a true statement because. Because he was, and David's point is well taken, he was a trenchant analyst of cultural evil. He was that. And this is why he came up with this idea of the Übermensch, the idea of the Superman whose calling would be to transcend the morality of the masses and overcome and by titanic assertion overcome and become the person that in a world without God will get rid of this sham and this hypocrisy that so caused him to vilify Christianity because that's precisely what he saw. So it's a good, David's point is well taken. By the way, this is one of the issues, one of the 12 objections that people raise to Christianity. It's in my book, I'm Glad You Asked. In that book, I discussed the 12 objections that I discovered over the years where all the questions, all the objections I've ever encountered were variations and combinations of these 12. Guess what one of them is? One of them is, what about the hypocrites? And there are very sub-questions within that. And part of my answer to that, it's just a part, but is this, that Jesus reserved his harshest words for the religious hypocrites, did he not? And if you're against hypocrisy, guess what? You're on Jesus' side. You're not against Jesus. You're actually agreeing with Jesus. And if you are to reject Jesus because of religious hypocrites, why plan to, you know, if you hate hypocrisy, why plan to spend eternity with them? So, you know, the hypocrites. Now, I don't go that far normally, but... But the point is well taken, though. Jesus hated hypocrisy because the religiousness of man, religiosity, I'm afraid, can lead to tremendous distortions. Where and that's what Nietzsche was catching on. And that's really a legitimate objection that many, even of the new atheists, make to the way religion can be used in perpetrating even many forms of evil. It was Pascal who said, men never do evil so cheerfully and fully as when they do it out of religious conviction. You see, that's when they really can do evil, you see. And I think that's true in the world today. Yes?
Ken, how do you respond to someone who is hesitant to give because they see that giving sacrificially might lead them into a position of being a poor witness for Christ because they were not able to fulfill their other obligations?
I would probably use 2 Corinthians 8 here, where he says that there's a great in a great deal of affliction, their abundance of joy and their deep poverty overflowed in the wealth of their liberality. For I testify that according to their ability and beyond their ability, they gave of their own accord, begging us with much urging for the favor of participating in the support of the saints. And then he says, and this not as we had expected, but they first gave themselves to the Lord and to us by the will of God. His point is they gave beyond their ability. And he says that, and he makes this very clear, you know the grace of our Lord Jesus Christ, that though he was rich, yet for your sake he became poor, and here's the key, that you through his poverty might become rich. You see that idea? Through his poverty. And there is indeed that image of how this can be in our own lives and in our own journeys. And then he makes it very clear. Now, who supplies 2 Corinthians 9:10, he who supplies seed to the sower and bread for food will supply and multiply your seed for sowing and increase the harvest of your righteousness. You will be rich, enriched in everything for all liberality, which through us is producing thanksgiving to God. For the ministry of this service is not only fully supplying the needs of the saints, but is also overflowing through many thanksgivings to God. I think that though I would I'd take them to 2 Corinthians 8
and 9. The money in and,
these are people who were giving beyond their means.
You know? And I say, that's why Jesus says, truly, I say to you, present tense, by contrast, with these hypocrites who were throwing money.
Remember, they were the trumpeting that idea, and they were just basically making sure that everybody could hear it. There was even this device here where they'd throw the money in, and they'd break it into small coins so that they could make a lot of noise. You know, and I say, this is why Jesus says, "Truly, truly, I say to you, present tense, they have their reward. Don't look for it later. This is it, buddy." You know, give him a hand, folks. That's all he's going to take from this rodeo. And that's basically what it comes down to. Now, I was about to go into a word about our speech. I have a book that was part of a wisdom series that I developed years ago. The first one was called Pursuing Wisdom, and that was on Proverbs 1-9. And then The Art of Living Well, which deals with Proverbs 10-31. The Proverbs don't begin until 9 chapters of setup. No Proverbs until chapter 10, verse 1. He's trying to, what's the point in giving wisdom if there's no taste for the subject, unless the person's prepared? So he prepares his son to receive the words of wisdom. And then in this section, in 9-21, I discuss in a categorical way, the character of the wise, communication and character, wisdom and wealth, that sort of thing. And there's an incredible amount of wisdom on the area of listening and on speaking in Proverbs. Tremendous wisdom in this area. It's my belief, by the way, that listening is an overlooked art. I used to, years ago, when I was living up in New York State, I used to teach effective listening workshops, one-day workshops for IBM managers in various facilities in the area. And So I was a resource for them, and I found that to be an incredibly interesting thing to develop and work with on that material. My friend Art Robertson worked on creating this material, and I became a presenter as well. And it really opened a whole world to me because I realized that listening is really the key to effective communication. And everybody gets courses on reading and writing, even sometimes on speaking. Who gets a course on reading, on listening? Yet we've been given two ears and one mouth. We ought to use them proportionately. There are a lot of people who speak the equivalent of a book in one day and who do not read a book in a year. You see, it's an interesting thing that there is this mindset that people have. And thus what happens is because nobody's actually educated into this, they inherit poor habits, like stepping on people's ideas, you see. Always interrupting, always playing a game of mental chess, trying to get the next move in, you see. They're not even thinking about what the jumping to conclusions, you see, and a variety of poor habits, not listening effectively. Few people have ever really been listened to effectively. In fact, that's why we have to pay therapists to do that. You have to pay professionals to listen to you effectively. And even there, I'm not sure in some cases whether they're really listening or not, or just parroting what you've just said. I hear you saying this. Well, give me something more now. No, I hear you saying that. I hear you being frustrated. I hear you doing this. You know, the talking cure has its limits. But the point here is that we need people who love us enough. And I concluded that listening effectively is other-centered and requires a mindset of being other-centered to put the needs of others above our own. And that takes some work. But I believe listening is really a key to effective communication, and communication is a key to effective relationships. But speech is also critical. And Proverbs has much to say both on listening and on speech. And I was tempted to do a whole thing next week just on speech, but I don't know. I think I'll put that off. It's good stuff, though. No, but at any rate, I just want to say a couple of words about this, though. That the wise will know the value of speech. The wise person knows the value of speech, that speech has the power, and our tongues have the power of life and death. It has the power to wound or to heal. It has the power to reward or trouble oneself. Words have power. And we are called then to use the words, but there's a downside for each of the things it can do powerfully and properly. There's also a negative side in which that can occur. A wise person knows the characteristics of wise words, that wise speech is honest and not false. It is, the wise person will use few words in comparison to many. Rarely have I regretted not saying something. Many is the time I've regretted saying something. Once the toothpaste is out of the tube, you can't put it back in. Really some dopey things that people say impulsively. That's why I think it's probably prudent for you to really monitor yourself before you jump to conclusions again and say something. This is why, when in doubt, don't. That's kind of my view of that matter. On a variety of areas. Again, I've seen this done where, oh, when's the baby due? And she gives him a withering look and says, I'm not pregnant. That's not a good move. If you're in doubt, don't. That's my view of the matter, you know? And you can always figure things out later on, you see. But this sort of thing, words have power. They can destroy. Sticks and stones may break my bones, but names will never hurt me. Do you remember that stupid proverb? That's not found from Proverbs. That's a dopey proverb, because it's totally untrue. I remember saying that when I was 5 years old. I still remember in Dumont, New Jersey, there was a group of kids who decided to just say some nasty things to me, and that was my brilliant response. Then I turned away and walked back, and I said, that ain't true. Words do hurt you. In fact, the word sarcasm comes from sarcasmos, which is a Greek word which means to cut. It means to cut the flesh. And words can cut and wound the spirit. You see, this is why, give every man your tongue, your ear, but few your voice. Take each man's censure and withhold your judgment. What's that from? Very good. Polonius to Laertes. It's to thine own self be true. But it's a lot of good counsel along the way. But give every man, what does he say? Give every man your ear, but there's some good wisdom in this, but few your voice. Take each man's censure, in other words, the rebuke, and reserve your judgment. Don't jump to conclusions. There may be some truth in that. There's a lot of wisdom in that little speech that he gives to his son.
Thank you for listening to this talk, which is part of a series of messages by Dr. Ken Boa. To order additional talks on CD or MP3, or to learn about any of Dr. Boa's other Bible-based teachings, go to our web ministry at kenboa.org. That's kenboa.org. Or call 1-800-DRAW-NEAR. That's 1-800-372-9632.